Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce the distinguished speaker for today's program. The title is The Health Consequences of Social Isolation with former NFL player Jonathan Martin and Beyond Differences team leaders. This panel will present eye-opening information about serious health and psychological effects of social isolation on youth. This dynamic panel of experts and student leaders will discuss everything from the root causes of social isolation to alarming statistics that impact everything from academic failure, including increased school truancy rates, to adverse medical outcomes, including the risk of obesity, substance abuse, and poor cardiovascular health. From the perspective of scientists to students to celebrities, our panelists will talk about how policy leaders, parents, teachers, students, and the media can help understand and end the epidemic of social isolation among the youth. Our panel includes Laura Thomas, who is the founder of Beyond Differences, a Bay Area nonprofit that empowers youth to end social isolation and create more inclusive school environments. Dr. Matt Pantel is a UCSF pediatrician who is part of a research study in 2013 that called Social Isolation and Morality a comparable predictor to mortality as traditional clinical risk factors, American Journal of Public Health. Jonathan Martin is a former NFL offensive tackle for the Dolphins and 49ers, a member of Stanford University's Cardinals, and a national spokesperson for Beyond Differences. And then we have two high school students, Eden Jensen and Carl Heil Simpson, in the Beyond Differences Leadership Program.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. My name is Laura Talmas, and I think we have a really terrific and very thoughtful presentation for you this evening. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. It's really an honor for us to be here. And I understand we stand a small chance of actually being rebroadcast on NPR. So if we are, I'll be sure to let everybody know if we were selected. I just want to do a little housekeeping. I want to recognize the members of our board that are here this evening. I want to start with my chair, Mike Wattenpaugh, who's here, as well as Dr. L.N. Roos, my sister Evie Talmas, who is not allowed to leave the board because she's one of the founding board members, and of course my husband and co-founder of Beyond Differences, Ace Smith. I hope I have not left out any other board members. I also want to thank the staff that's here tonight, John Finifrock, Chrissy Hyatt, and Jenny Carl. As you all know, without great staff, there's really not much work that gets done at a small and thriving nonprofit. I think we'll just start with a little bit of background about Beyond Differences so you can get maximum time with the panelists. But as you've seen behind me, we have a mission statement that talks about ending social isolation in middle school, inspiring and empowering the youth to lead that change. And while many of you really do know us and support us already, I do hope that you'll learn something this evening. We have powerful voices up here next to me of both youth and adults, so everybody has stories about social isolation. Our beginnings were improbable but true, as many of you know. We're only 6 years old, and we've gained a very strong foothold in the world of social-emotional learning for youth all across the United States. The way we do it, how we do it, and why we do it is probably the most interesting part of our story. Many of you do know that, unfortunately, it began with the passing of Ace and my daughter, Lily, who was, although we didn't have the words at the time, socially isolated in middle school. We knew that she had a hard time, and she became increasingly with fewer and fewer friends. By the time she was in seventh grade, it was time to move Lily. She was now showing classic signs of being socially isolated. She didn't want to go to school. She really was depressed a lot, and her academic achievements were starting to fail. Lily was born with Apert syndrome, and whether that or another reason was why she didn't seem to find herself with enough friends, we'll never know. But she had a great spirit, as many of you know, and she picked herself up, finished middle school, and went off to a college preparatory boarding school where she passed away in her sleep. She was just 15 years old. I always tell the story about Lily to classes of middle schoolers, and I'd be sure to tell them that Lily did not hurt herself, nor did anybody hurt Lily. And so it was natural causes that she passed away. However, That is why we started Beyond Differences. It really was a group of people who cared and loved about her, including former classmates who came together, and through a confluence of absolutely crazy things, we ended up starting Beyond Differences. Who are we? Well, we're built on three fundamental principles. One, we are and have been all along the only organization that is singularly focused on ending social isolation. Today, there are a lot of organizations talking about that, and we're thrilled that they're jumping in the fray. But we maintain that purpose because we know that social isolation really hurts kids. We all know about bullying. We all know about teasing. And heaven forbid, we know about self-harm and even suicide that children commit. We also know that social isolation is oftentimes the precursor to the kind of community violence that we see in the world. The shooters, as you know from reading the horrific accounts in the press, will all be described as someone who was socially isolated, alone, disconnected from their community, and oftentimes with no friends. That is the reason why we maintain our focus on social isolation. We think we know what social isolation looks like. In Lily's case, she was classically the kid who hung around in the classroom with a friendly teacher, didn't want to go to the lunchroom, she hid in the girls' bathroom, or she went to the library every time she had to mingle with kids her own age. But we've heard from children, including from others that are on the panel with me, that we don't always know that kids are socially isolated, but they are. They may look like they've got a lot of friends. They may be sitting amidst a group of friends, but they feel invisible. They feel left out. They feel alone, and it's starting to really hurt. I am so grateful that Dr. Matt Pantel is with us tonight because he's going to really show us the research-based evidence about social isolation. Second, we're also the only organization that is totally focused on student leadership as the agents of that change. We really believe that students have the power to influence each other more than adults do at this age of adolescence. One of the things that ACE likes to talk about, which I think is fantastic, is that we're creating a new generation of leaders and not just a new class of victims. We are interested in the positive things that kids can do to influence one another, and we're really focused on that. In fact, I'm really blessed to be surrounded by two of our 51 teen board members who are in high school and take the time out of their school day every single week, every single month, to go to a local or faraway middle school to lead assemblies, to speak, to teach classes, to staff overnight retreats, and to often go out and speak in public to adults such as this evening. They're also the ones who help lead our national awareness days like No One Eats Alone, which, as you all know, was in 1,121 schools just a couple of weeks ago, and all 50 United States. So that's a big point to brag about in just 6 years. We've now expanded to Portland, and we're moving over to Oakland Unified School District. So we've got a lot going on. The last thing I want to talk about is that we're still inspired by Lily. Lily's story may be my reason for waking up every day and doing Beyond Differences, and it may not be anybody else's, but I've seen the reaction of kids and audiences who still to this day watch a 6-minute video we made about Lily's life, and you could hear a pin drop. It doesn't matter who the kids are, when they hear powerful stories from their peers, people stop and listen. So we're here about personal stories tonight. I'm really delighted that Jonathan's here. He's become a new friend and someone who I think is very courageous for speaking out about what he's been through and inspiring youth to also tell their stories. So I know Jonathan is going to be happy to answer questions. So we're going to set the table with science. And although Matt's bio has probably been already given to you, I would like to brag a little bit about our friend Dr. Matt Pantel, who from the moment we met, Matt has never said no to Beyond Differences. We partner together a lot. We've submitted grants together to get funding. I'm really very validated by the science and the medicine and the learning that Matt has taught us, and it's part of why we keep going. So Matt graduated from UC Berkeley, UCSF Joint Medical Program. He earned his MD and his master's in health and medical sciences. He's worked at the National Institutes of Health and the Urban Institute, a policy think tank in Washington, D.C., on projects investigating social determinants of health. He has a particular interest in the relationship between social isolation and health outcomes, as well as how childhood adversity affects health throughout the life course. He's finishing his residency in pediatrics at UCSF, where he works closely with the Center on Health and Community, and will serve this summer as the chief resident of UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital. So I'm really delighted to welcome Dr. Matt Pantel.
I think because I have a wireless mic, I'll stand to point at the slides. Thanks for the intro, Laura, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having me here. I'm really excited to be a part of this this panel. So if we could go to the next slide. Let's see. Oh, perfect. So so I'm going to talk a little bit about the study of the relationship between social isolation and health outcomes, which actually has been going on for centuries. And a seminal work in this field was actually done by Emile Durkheim, who's a famous sociologist and in France. And he wrote a book called Suicide. I'm not going to butcher the French pronunciation. But in 1897, he wrote this book looking into risk factors and trying to understand what were some of the risk factors for people who were committing suicide. And one of the strongest predictors that he found was indeed social isolation. And so he really sparked a lot of the field looking into social isolation and then health outcomes. And it's hard to look at some of the medical journals that talk about social isolation and health today without them mentioning Emile Durkheim. And so that book has been republished and republished because it really hits on this theme that has come throughout the past few centuries. And if you go to the next slide. So there's been a ton of studies investigating the relationship between social isolation and health since Durkheim's days. A lot of them started in the 70s and 80s, and there's been a lot more in the past decade as well. One of the ones that we did a couple of years ago is we actually looked at a national sample of thousands and thousands of Americans throughout the country. And what we did is we looked at them over a period of 15 years, and we tracked based on social isolation, their sort of mortality risk. And so if you see here, and forgive me, podcast viewers, you can't see this, but there's a survival curve. And on the left here, you can see this is the percentage of people surviving at each month of follow-up. 200 months is about 15 years. And so at each month, you see the proportion of people who are still alive. And what we found is that based on social isolation, you can see that the more isolated you are, that's the people in red here, the steeper the mortality curve, meaning that they're at higher risk of mortality at each step along the way. You can see the people on top in black, that's the most socially integrated people, the most friends, and feeling the least isolated. And there's sort of like a graded a relationship here. The more isolated you feel, the higher the mortality risk over time. And this specific study, we controlled for a lot of factors, and it stayed the same. And this is actually the graph showing women, but the results are same for men as well. And then if you go to the next slide, another thing is that we looked at was, you know, how strong of a predictor is social isolation compared to a lot of the other traditional clinical medical risk factors that we look at. And what we did, if you take the left there and look at women, you can see in red is the risk, again, of mortality over the follow-up period. And you can see this is sort of a hazard ratio, so the higher it is, the increased risk you have of passing away over the study period. And so those who were very isolated had about a 1.5 times increased risk of passing away compared to those who were least isolated. And you can see it was not quite as high a risk factor, a stronger risk factor as smoking, but it was actually a stronger risk factor than obesity, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol here. And for men, it was actually the strongest predictor of mortality over the follow-up period compared to the other risk factors. You can see for very isolated people, it's a little bit higher than smoking. It's not significantly different. But we concluded from looking at this that social isolation is sort of an equally good predictor of mortality over 15, 20 years for these patients and this general population. And since then, there have been a lot of, in the past few years, there have been a lot of studies looking at other health outcomes, and it's not just mortality, it's specific types of mortality, it's cardiovascular mortality, it's infectious disease mortality, it's looking at outcomes in terms of functional ability, in terms of ability to walk, in terms of decline in old age. And it's also looking at biomarkers and subclinical markers of health. And it turns out that there are markers of inflammation that are higher in people who are socially isolated than people who are not socially isolated. And if you go to the next slide, just now there's been more work looking into how childhood social isolation and adolescent social isolation affects outcomes. And this study was looking at, on the y-axis there, is the percentage of people who have a poor cardiovascular health as measured by a lot of clinical and biomarker factors. And What you can see on the x-axis here is this study was looking at time periods that people were socially isolated in their life. So, and basically, zero means they weren't ever. One means they were isolated either in childhood or adolescence. And two means they were isolated in both time periods. And you can see as you increase in the length of time that you were socially isolated, your risk as an adult of having poor cardiovascular health increases sort of stepwise. And this is true for both men and women. And these studies and these themes are repeated over and over again with different outcomes. And then if you go to the next slide, we're only just scratching the surface in terms of looking at least in the medical literature, looking at things that I know our panelists can know are true and have seen in their work, is that social isolation does have relationships to mental and physical health in childhood. And so actually a study by Dabney in London that looked at all of the studies and compiled them that you can find on the Beyond Differences website does a really nice job summarizing. And basically you can see from the slide that social isolation is associated in childhood with mental health effects, including increased anxiety and depression, poor sleep habits, and physical health effects such as worse overall physical health, abdominal pain, headaches, and increased risk of having subclinical markers like high cholesterol in childhood. So, and again, this is on the Beyond Differences website. It's a great report that you can look at actually the relationships between isolation and health outcomes in childhood that have already gone on. And so, lastly, I just want to say, so my point is sort of that there's a lot of research that's backing this up now in the medical literature, but also anecdotally as sort of a training pediatrician, I can say that I've seen how social isolation has affected my patients since starting residency and even as a medical student. And, you know, one of my jobs as a clinician is to not only identify and treat disease, but also to promote health and well-being. And I think, you know, while training and residency is focused on managing of clinical disease, equally as important is sort of these social factors, which have a tremendous influence over the ability of my patients to flourish and sort of also can lead them to a lot of struggles. So I think that in order for us to really ensure that this generation of kids grows up and is as healthy as they can be, we have to not only treat their medical pathologies, but also to understand and address the social factors like social isolation that really, really have an effect on kids' ability to thrive. So I hope that some of these slides have shown you something that you can look up and into more, and please email me if you'd like to get any of the studies. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. We're going to have lots of time for questions. Speaking of this generation, it's now my pleasure to ask Eden and Carl each to give us a little bit of a sense of where they're coming from and how social isolation may have affected them personally or what they've seen among their peer group. And just very quickly, Eden is a junior at Tamil Pius High School in Mill Valley and has been on the Beyond Differences team board of directors for 3 years. Eden grew up playing with my daughter Lily, so she's devoted to spreading awareness in middle schools on how to end social isolation. And in her free time, which is very important, Eden enjoys SoulCycle, hanging out with her friends and participating in pole vaulting in track and field for the Tamil Pius High School track team, if you can believe somebody pole vaults. And then Carl is a junior at Redwood High School in Larkspur. He joined Beyond Differences 4 years ago and loves the work that he does. When Carl is not studying, he can be found on the rugby pitch or with friends and family. And I love these guys. They really are just two of the 52 joys of being the director of Beyond Differences. So Eden, give us something.
Well, when I was in middle school, I didn't think I was socially isolated until I really understood what social isolation was. Most people I knew wouldn't really think I was socially isolated. I was a competitive gymnast involved in my school, and I had what looked to be a great group of friends. But even though I appeared to fit in, there were times I was excluded from group chats about sleepovers, weekend plans, and parties, including one around 8th grade graduation. That may not sound like a big deal for some of you, but for teens, being apart and being left out of social media is huge, and it definitely was for me in middle school. I was very aware of bullies, but that wasn't really my situation. I didn't have a way to put into words how I felt. I found myself at many times watching people even being bullied right in front of me, and I found myself not really doing anything about it. All I really wanted to do in middle school was fit in and stay in with the crowd, but little did I know I was being a bystander in many situations. When Beyond Differences formed and I heard about Lily's story about being left out because she looked different, I began to understand what social isolation really was and all of the different components of it. I never noticed that Lily looked different. When I grew up, I really just found her as a friend. Maybe it was because I was 5 years younger, but she just looked like a friend to me. And knowing what she went through in middle school and what other middle schoolers and teens experience every day, I wanted to make a change and help schools be more inclusive. When we go into middle schools and talk about social isolation, the response is always really powerful. Students open up and share their stories about being vulnerable or when they've been in situations like I have and really haven't done anything about being a bystander in situations. And you would think teens in the Bay Area would be raised with such a high level of social awareness and empathy, but really teens are teens all over the country, and middle school is a hard time for everyone. So programs like Be Kind Online and No One Eats Alone and Be the One address the key issues that middle schoolers face around online communication, making schools more inclusive, starting with the longest hour of the day for kids who feel left out, and teaching teens to be upstanders instead of bystanders.
Thank you. Do you need this? This one.
Picture me, 6 inches shorter, a sixth grader, 12 years old. I just moved here. I'm a new kid from Los Angeles. And I'm a Dodgers fan. Now, it's 2010, and as we all know, it was the great year that the Giants won the World Series for the first time in God knows how long. So I'm sitting there in one of my classes, my fifth grade class, with my Dodgers hat on, watching the parade with my classmates. And I'm being ridiculed because I'm wearing a Dodgers hat. People are saying, go back to L.A. The Dodgers suck, and so do you. They'd take my hat, they'd throw it on the ground, they'd run away with it, make me chase them. It seemed so silly. And yet it had such a profound effect on me. And I didn't really realize at the time what social isolation was. I often didn't really understand that if I was really being bullied. And later on, I kind of realized that it was a lot of different things going on. Not only was I a new kid, not only was I a Dodgers fan, I was a colored kid. I'm half white and half black. And when you move to a place where most people don't really look like you, they can be a little threatened. And that was the vibe I got. I always got comments about my race. Whether it be like, you're an Oreo, chocolate bear, you're good at sports because you're black, you're good at school because you're black, you're going to get scholarships because you're black. Everything was because I was black. And I didn't understand. I didn't know why. Like, why me? I was just a kid in a school. And it kind of took a long time for me to realize, but it really is the little things that people say that matter. We always think that it has to be someone beating you up on the playground or somebody hurling insults at you in the hallway. But it can be something as simple as someone taking your hat away. It can be something as simple as your allegiance to a team. It could be something as simple as the color of your skin, believe it or not. It's the 21st century, and that's absolutely insane. So when I joined Beyond Differences, I made a pledge to myself that I would never let anybody that I ever saw feel isolated for their race, for their team allegiance, or for anything else, anything, no matter how insignificant it may seem. The little things matter.
Jonathan doesn't need much of a bio read, but I do want to say how proud we are to have you for the next few months at least as the national spokesperson for Beyond Differences. Until his retirement from the NFL in July of 2015, Jonathan played for the Miami Dolphins, for the San Francisco 49ers, and for the Carolina Panthers. His experiences with social isolation and harassment as a member of the Miami Dolphins were front page news in the fall of 2013. From those experiences, Jonathan has learned the need to take on these tough issues directly and publicly. He's now speaking out on behalf of Beyond Differences to teach students how to be kind to one another and, to embrace differences. For young boys and girls to meet and hear Jonathan Martin's message of personal healing and hope is to know that no matter how big or how small you are, being left out hurts. Jonathan's message is simple. We are all better off when we make the change that allows everyone to feel included, valued, respected, and accepted by their peers. I'm so grateful to have you here tonight, Jonathan, and to tell your story.
Thank you, Laura. Now, I don't know how many of you know my story. I'm 6'5", used to weigh 315 pounds, and I was bullied as a kid. I felt like I didn't have friends for a long time in middle school and high school. Now, I'm originally from the East Coast, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in Pittsburgh, I went to a school that was populated mostly by middle class and working class families. Now, both of my parents are professionals. My father is a professor. My mom is an attorney. So to these kids, I was the rich kid, the rich black kid. And this was mostly to the black kids. So I felt like I didn't fit in with that group. And at the same time, looking at myself in the mirror, I knew I wasn't white. When I moved to Los Angeles, I was 10 years old in the year 2000. And I went to a school that was populated by the children of Hollywood's rich and famous. Majority white, very privileged school. You know, it was a blessing to have gone there. But at the same time, I found myself on the other end of the spectrum. Instead of feeling or being told that I was the rich kid, I was now the poor kid. And the feelings of not fitting in with the black kids or the white kids deepened. It took me a long time to make friends. I was shy. I felt like I didn't have anything in common with anyone. I grew up playing the violin and reading books, and not a lot of the other kids my age had these same things in common with me. Now, in addition to this, being black and surrounded by mostly white kids half my size, my parents had always taught me that, you know, you're going to be treated differently by society. And I internalized that. When I went to middle school, I befriended some of the black kids, but at the same time, I was still the white black kid. So it was either one or the other, the rich white black kid or the poor black kid. And to compound this, I was also a very sensitive kid. I didn't realize until many years later, just a few years ago actually, that I have a predisposition to depression, major depression, and anxiety. I was constantly self-conscious, trapped in my own head. Little things that didn't bother most kids, teasing or whatever, would stick in my mind. I would think of them for days on end. As a response to this, feeling like I didn't fit in, I became a bully myself and started bullying other kids that were different. It was a form of redirecting attention away from myself and to others who didn't fit in with the crowd. I wanted to be one of the cool kids. I wanted to be cool. In addition to this, I used my self-hatred and anger as fuel to make myself good at football. I managed to be a two-time All-American in college and play in the NFL for 3 years. While I was at Stanford, I felt like I fit in. Stanford is a very special place full of people with all kinds of diverse backgrounds and lots of weird people, lots of nerds. And I felt like I fit right in with all the weirdos and nerds. I felt like I'd emerged from my feeling of isolation, that I was different from others, until I found myself my rookie year in the NFL. I had some teammates that aren't good people, and I'm a big guy, but they were even bigger, some of them much bigger. And they were mean. I had gotten bullied by kids half my size in middle school, and now I found myself in the NFL at 22 years old getting bullied by guys larger than myself. all of my accomplishments, the money, the fame, all the trappings of being a professional athlete couldn't overcome this feeling of social isolation that I felt. I felt like I was right back in middle school. Didn't fit in with the white guys, didn't fit in with the black guys. I already had depression, and that worsened significantly. I attempted suicide a number of times, engaged in other unsavory activities to try and overcome this kind of anxiety and unease that I felt on a daily basis. I had a breakdown of sorts during my second year in the NFL. Left my team and checked into a mental hospital. During the months and years following the incident and my time with the Dolphins, I've worked hard to overcome the deep emotional wounds that I developed in middle school, high school, that were reopened in the NFL. But through this process, I came to the realization that those people don't matter. People, you're always going to have detractors, and you've got to realize that they don't matter in the grand scheme of things. Since retiring from the NFL, I was lucky enough to be put in contact with Ace and Laura with Beyond Differences. And it's really been a really fulfilling experience to see the impact this can have on kids and how widespread an issue this is. And I have a unique platform of sorts to address this as a very large person that feels the same way as a lot of kids currently feel in school. I really just have one more thing that I want to say is, you know, it seems like it's such a simple thing to be kind to each other, but really kindness is the true bravery they can show as opposed to putting someone else down just to keep yourself up. Thank you, Laura.
So I'm going to just start out by asking a couple of questions. Carl, you may have something else that you'd like to share about being on the teen board, and I know Eden would love to as well. Do you want to do that now? Do you have an experience that you'd like to talk about, riffing off of what Jonathan just said? Maybe about the assembly that you...
Absolutely.
Great. That would be great, and then we'll do a couple of questions.
So as a teen board member of Beyond Differences, we do a lot of assemblies, and we talk to a lot of kids all over the place. And I honestly have lost track of how many assemblies I've done, but there are specific cases and specific stories from certain assemblies that definitely stick out in your mind when you've done so many. And one of these happened when I was a sophomore last year. I was leading a small group of kids. It was about 20 kids. And when we're in small groups, we just ask a few questions. And one of these questions is to share a story about how you've either been socially isolated someone else, or been a bystander. And this one kid, this little kid, see him up there, raised his hand, and he told a story about how he'd been isolated because he was short ever since he was in, like, first grade. He was already in about seventh grade then, still short. And I was thinking to myself, still, like, this is so little and so insignificant, like, toughen up, little guy. It's a hard world out there. And then I looked over at him, and there were tears streaming down his face. He was crying in front of all of his classmates. He broke, basically. And that's part of the reason why I always say the little things matter, because that comes out on people's faces. There's a certain breaking point that you reach. I've reached it, and I'm sure tons of people around the world, maybe even in this room, have reached that point from such a little thing. And all I could really do was put my arm around him and say, it's going to be okay, I'm here for you. And just me doing that got all the rest of the kids in this group to join in and comfort this kid and care about him. And to me, that just showed what we're all about. That showed the impact of what we're doing. One assembly. And that still sticks out in my mind every day. And I just wanted to share that with all of you.
Thank you. Thank you. So I have a question from Matt. Dr. Pantel, what can clinics, clinicians, therapists, and healthcare organizations do about this? And how does the healthcare sector respond to this huge public health crisis that we have?
Thanks for the question, Laura. Yeah, I think we're just starting to see physicians and clinicians and healthcare workers get more and more interested in this question because you can't really ignore the science anymore. And there have been a couple of talks by some big groups about what to do about it as well. Personally, I think one thing and a theme that's sort of come up here is just sort of education about it, just knowing that that social isolation can be the root of a lot of issues going on. You know, you guys talk about it going on at schools and also in patients' lives. And, I've talked to a lot of my colleagues who are sort of, I deem them sort of non-believers, and then I sort of talked to them about it, and they weren't as interested in social determinants of health research, and I showed them the slides, and they were like, we get it, but we don't have time. And it's been interesting to see them develop in the last few years. And, you know, I'm talking pediatricians, and I'm talking geriatricians, the whole life spectrum, and people have said to me and come back to me later and said, I can't believe I didn't listen to you. My socially isolated patients, this just surrounds all of their issues, all of their health issues, all of their, their mental health issues. And so I think one of the first things is sort of education and just getting the word out there about this. And then secondly, I do think there are sort of things that we can do in terms of screening for it. And, the Institute of Medicine, which is an organization that actually does reports and makes recommendations to Congress and to different medical boards about what we should do in healthcare, actually reviewed last year, actually in 2014, a lot of social factors, and they actually rated social isolation as a top priority for something to be screened in electronic medical records. And they think that the data they rated as something as you can't ignore, and actually the utility is something you can't ignore because it is so closely tied to health outcomes. Now, they're sort of advocating for screening, and then people ask, what do you do with that? And I think that's what we're still figuring out the best things. There are sort of trials going on about increasing, social support and sort of figuring out who is isolated and seeing how we can connect them to resources, whether that's groups at school or outside of school for kids and adolescents, and whether that's, isolated adults and elders, getting them involved in community groups or visitors to come and see them at home. So there are a few things that people are trying as interventions. But I think ultimately, the more we talk about it and the more ideas will come up and the more sort of collaborations between groups like, Beyond Differences, which you guys have great programming that's addressing this and was addressing it way ahead of the research, more of those can come about. So I think some stuff is starting, and stay tuned for the other interventions.
Thanks, Matt. I think it's amazing to me that just 6 years ago, if you Googled social isolation, you found studies about seniors and the life expectancy of seniors who were suffering from loneliness and being shut in. There was no discussion about adolescents. We now know, as you've taught me, there's evidence, there's science. We've been companions on this road together, and I am so thrilled that you're doing this work at UCSF and one of the preeminent institutions in the world. So this is good. We're going to keep doing more work together. And then, Jonathan, I wanted to ask you, I honestly stole this question from the kids that we just did an assembly with the other day, but can you help us understand what you think high schools, colleges, and even pro football organizations should be thinking about regarding what you went through? Similarly, thinking about even sexual assault, to fundamentally take a violent game and coach the players both on and off the field about their behavior and attitude towards each other and towards women?
Well, I think primarily you have to start with the NFL. It's the highest profile of those that you mentioned. I think a lot of kids see NFL players, professional athletes in general, as role models. And because they're public figures and in the spotlight, they should be held to a higher standard. I think the NFL should be embarrassed a lot of ways for a lot of the behavior they let go on. They've addressed it in some ways. They're working to improve, but there's still a lot of strides that need to be made. I think with a game as violent as football is, people think that that should does extend off the field, but that doesn't have to be the case. I know firsthand from playing at Stanford, is a bunch of, like I said, nerds and weirdos just hanging out in the locker room. And that was a distinct departure from what I saw in the NFL.
Thank you. That's great. I think we have about 15 minutes, so I really do want to make sure that the audience has time to ask any of the panelists, the kids, and Jonathan and Matt, questions.
Okay. We've been listening to a panel discussion on the health consequences of social isolation with former NFL player Jonathan Martin and Beyond Differences team leaders. And now this is a program is open for audience questions, and let me give you the microphone before you ask the question.
Hi. I'm interested in both in medical research and at home. How does one gauge the level of social isolation that someone's feeling? It's not, you're not taking a blood test or things that you can measure perhaps quite as specifically. How does that get reported?
Hello? Can you? Yeah, thanks for the question. The short answer is a lot of ways, and but there are two sort of overall, I'd say there are two overarching sort of themes. One is more subjective, and one is more objective. So, and there's actually a debate about which is more important in the medical field. But so one of the things involves sort of social support, and that generally is applied to a term applied to sort of subjective feelings of feeling belonging, feeling like I have a friend that I could count on, I have a family member I could count on, I feel like emotionally supported by the resources that I have. And it's not necessarily a number of resources or anything like that, but just saying that you actually feel support. And questions that sort of are in a similar vein as that. The other term is sort of called social integration, and that would be sort of more objective measures like married or partnered, going to a community group at least once a month, going to a religious group a few times a month, you know, seeing friends a few times. It was sort of like almost like a you know, they set sort of different levels of like that they consider as being socially integrated. In general, those measures are kind of, and that was the one actually we used, which in general is actually a terrible measure. It's sort of like it was very, very. It was like if you see your friends more than three times a week, you get a point. If you go to church more than, you know, this, that, which you hear and you're like, that sounds so robotic and not representative. But actually, no matter how you measure it and how bad the measures are, how good the measures are, the story is actually consistently the same. So some of them are actually asking how you sort of feel about your support, and the others are actually sort of measuring like that. And usually social isolation is equally applied as the absence of either of those two things.
Thank you. I have a question about with the youth, and we have inspired youth now working. I love that you're doing this at this level because it kind of makes sense. But I'm wondering if the youth are inspiring adults to end social isolation.
You want me to do that?
I'll chime in.
All right.
As far as my experience goes, I've talked to a lot of adults. I've been to a lot of events, and I even was lucky enough to travel across the country to a couple of conferences and met with some people from a bunch of different tech organizations, from Google to Yahoo, some government organizations, the FCC, the FTC, I think, as well. But the story is often the same. You kind of go up to these people and they ask us, like, what is your organization about? And we're like, we're about ending social isolation. And often people don't know what it is, so you kind of have to explain to them what it is. And once you've done that, they completely understand what you're talking about. They start thinking of examples. They start thinking of their own children. Funnily enough, somebody actually asked me for parenting advice about social media. I think it's a big issue that a lot of adults are now noticing. And once you explain to them what it is, they definitely get very passionate about ending it and understanding what's going on, because they were once kids, they have kids, and they genuinely care. So I think the adult population is very, very responsive to our message.
Yeah, I definitely think that what we stand for is such a relevant subject that everyone has been through. I'm sure even teachers, when we go up to teachers and talk to them about what we stand for and how they can get involved, even in the teacher conference room, they feel socially isolated. So it's so relevant for everyone that's why we're so successful in what we do and spreading awareness about such a impacting cause that we just...
I want to just echo that when I hear from parents, it's usually because the kids have come home from an assembly and told their moms and dads what they heard in the assembly. And I think as we all remember, it's really hard to pry out of your children what they did at school during the day. Some of the best examples we've heard are in those car rides when the parents will ask the same question every day, what'd you do, what'd you do, what'd you do? And usually it's nothing, I don't know, I can't remember. And this time it's, I heard a story today about a little girl, we saw a movie, we had a group of high school kids come to our middle school. It's been incredible, and I get handwritten notes and hopefully contributions, but it's because it's going the other way and not top down but bottom up. And we love that. I tell the kids they're like the Occupy movement. I want you to go occupy middle school and do it in a great way so that basically we can change the world together. More questions?
In this age of social media, I'm wondering, especially the two high school students, what you think the impact is of social media on social isolation?
Funny you ask. We went into the Ask FM headquarters because that was a big problem that we had. That's still happening. Cyberbullying and all of the things regarding that, mean comments are also really incorporated with social isolation. We just, we've talked to the CEO of Ask FM, and it's just, we live in a world of social media, and every day people get comments that make them feel degraded about themselves, that we're really trying to get the word out about that as well with Be Kind Online Day and Be the One on how we can try to end that as well, because every day, it's just, we have our day at school where kids may feel socially isolated, and it carries on in their home life as well, which is just awful. So,
I'm just going to chime in real quick. We've talked a lot about safety online, and we've also done a bit of research, and I did a bit of research before we met with Ask FM regarding suicides related to social media, and there actually have been quite a number of them. And it's kind of insane to think of that because, I mean, it's somebody hiding behind a keyboard saying mean things about you or subtly making comments about you. And people are driven to suicide because of this. And as Aiden said, it goes from school to your home. So you're never going to really get away from it. Even if you do, as I say, close the computer, turn off your phone, like you're never going to ever be away from social media today unless you live in the woods or you're Amish or something. I don't know.
Amish. And it's the anonymity as well that Ask FM allows kids to post things that don't require any validation of email address or identity. It's very hurtful, and we've spent a lot of time on that.
How are you seeing the presidential election and the language that we're seeing in this presidential election play out when you go to assemblies? And how do you think you and Beyond Differences might be able to help this and create a more civil discourse in society?
Oh. President, Carl.
Well, that is a massive question, especially seeing as Donald and his remarks that we see very often. Honestly, you could say the whole thing about the entire Republican Party. They're hurling all kinds of stuff at each other right now. I kind of lost track of it. But I think as far as Beyond Differences goes in there, we could end up speaking to a lot more politicians. We have some connections to politicians, but I think the way to get any kind of change regarding even the highest levels of government or anything is to start it in the people. It has to be grassroots. And honestly, the power comes from the people. And if these politicians are going to hurl insults at each other all day and degrade each other online, we have to tell them that it's not okay. Because since they have the power right now, and it seems to be like nobody cares what they're saying right now or they're entertained by it, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change. So the way that we can do that is by spreading it to as many people as we can ourselves. And those people will then get online themselves or go to rallies themselves and actually say to these people, well, we think this is not okay. Or somebody else is going to come up from the masses and become a politician and be like, well, I'm going to not stand for this anymore, because no matter what, it has to come from us. Like, the impact we have has to be all the people, all inclusive.
I love talking politics. So I do this. No, I think your question is interesting because it speaks more to the roles that males are expected to play or taught to play in society. Boys will be boys is almost spilling over into, you know, political discourse. And I think something that Beyond Differences can do is kind of challenge that basis that boys need to act a certain way, that you need to toughen up and get over it. I think that can be damaging to a lot of kids. And it's something that with visible politicians and other figures, it's where it starts. It starts at the top, and you move on from there.
I think that's one of the reasons why our programs like No One Eats Alone has grown so fast in such a short number of years, because we're all over the media and people are hungry for something that's kind. They're trying to teach their kids a better lesson about how to lean into differences instead of all the nonsense we hear on the news about having anxiety around differences. That's what the adults are saying. The kids are doing the better job. And as far as I can tell, it's going to spread faster because of that.
We've heard some very, you see all these stories are inspiring, and Jonathan, your story is also very inspiring. Could you, the difficulty you had in a male, you know, guys will be guys sort of society there, could you share some, maybe some, I mean, it seems there's a lot of negativity of your experience. What were some of the positive, have we had some positive outcomes? I mean, we heard so many negative things about the NFL in particular. Are there any positives, or are we sort of lost there?
You know, I think the positive that can come out of something like that is it's an issue that is swept under the carpet far too often, right? So it's if it's in your face, you have to confront it. And I think on a lot of different fronts, the notion boys will be boys is being confronted both with Love Wins movement and other things. You know, it's just like this acceptance, the culture of acceptance is increased. And I think from my experience in particular, just the fact that even, you know, regardless of size or, you know, social stature in terms of being a professional athlete, you could still be affected. So I think my story can possibly help other kids that are feeling sort of the same way, and hopefully bring this issue more to the forefront so it can be confronted, and hopefully we can improve as a society together.
Actually, if I can pick up on that question, I was struck all of you have sports athletics in your backgrounds at some level. Teams feel like an obvious place to actually create integration and reduce isolation. What are the attributes of like a good inclusive team, and can that be leveraged somehow to kind of confront some of this stuff?
I would say that the locker room is obviously not conversations that go on there are not the same conversations you could ever have anywhere else, right? There's definitely you have a license to make jokes and other things that wouldn't be normally socially acceptable, but there's still a line of respect involved, right? We're still on the same plateau, right? So if someone starts to feel uncomfortable because of language that's being used, then it shuts off. And that's something I didn't encounter during my experience in Miami. And I don't remember what was the back part of your question.
The attributes of an inclusive team.
So the attributes exclusive. Of an inclusive team, I guess, just understanding people's boundaries, because everyone's boundaries are different. And, you know, all jokes push boundaries, but at some point you got to kind of gauge the person's reaction. Or, you know, there's certain topics that shouldn't be touched altogether. So it's just all about mutual respect and communication.
You're on a rugby team and you are on a track and field team. Anything?
As a rugby player, it's kind of, in my opinion, a very extremely team-oriented sport. It's almost like a war. You play for the guy right next to you. They're your lifeline. They're your bloodline. And you'd think that there's always going to be a very, very strong sense of camaraderie, which there is, and that's a big thing that we're known for as a sport. But one of the things I've noticed on my own team is that there are those select few people who do get isolated quite a lot, and it's something that you can't it's really hard to deal with because everybody's got very differing opinions about it, and it does get very clicky. But I think overall, the positive thing about the team is that everybody is still pretty together, and even if there is an issue, somebody's going to sort it out anyway because we have to play with each other on Saturday. We have to go out there. We have to go smash people. That's basically what we do all day. We do it together. You live or die by the next guy, the guy next to you. So you kind of have to, you have to put your differences aside. You have to own up to whatever you did, own up to whatever you said in that environment. And I think that's what makes any team really a strong team, even if we have our disagreements or dislikes.
Do you have anything to add? You don't have to. Okay.
Yeah.
Should we go to the next question? Yeah. Okay. Maybe one or two more. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a quick question, primarily for Jonathan, but possibly for the two team board members as well. Around this idea that hazing and harassment in the NFL seems to be institutionalized, and hazing, as you pointed out, the boys will be boys kind of thing. Hazing is something that is prevalent in colleges and fraternities, and now increasingly we're seeing it in high schools, both in teams and sort of in more social settings. Can you discuss a little bit potentially around some of the hazing that goes on at the NFL around things like the rookies having to pay for the $5,000 steak dinners, that type of stuff, and then more specifically around how maybe organizations can stop hazing and break the cycle? Because sometimes it's, I got hazed, so I'm going to haze.
I think it speaks to what I mentioned earlier. You know, if you're getting punked or bullied, you feel the need to do it to the next person. Part of it is also it's seen as a rite of passage in ways. I think that's a old school mindset that is starting to die in some ways, but still exists in the NFL, especially. And it's framed as a way of team building, that we're making each other closer by, you know, forcing you to do something so that you can be considered an equal. But at the same time, I think it really is just centered around the same age-old notion, boys will be boys, right? And as we've seen, there have been incidents across the nation of hazing gone awry. And little activities, jokes, or whatever may be fine, but there needs to be some common sense involved when, you know, trying to do something to the new people on the squad. So I've seen things even in college where it's just like little funny things. They all ended funny. The person was laughing, everyone's laughing. But when it's like actually demeaning and or something dangerous, like I guess happens in some fraternities and stuff, then clearly there needs to be some sort of accountability and a line drawn in the sand for that.
Eden and Carl, would you comment on video games in middle school and high school, and how does that relate to social isolation? Does it correlate, cause and effect? What do you say to kids who seem to be isolated in that activity?
I haven't really come across a lot of kids who've talked to me specifically about video games isolating them, but one thing that I have noticed, because, I mean, I've played a lot of video games myself, especially online, you have a lot of people who have headsets, and they tend to say quite a few very nasty things, ranging from racial slurs to homophobic things. They'll insult your family, your mothers especially. I think that definitely can play a role in people's anger that they exhibit towards other people outside of the video games. It can also lead to people having worse depression. But I think the world of video games is kind of like a lunchroom, just 10 times more brutal overtly, because you're behind a screen and a controller. It's much like having a keyboard in front of you, except this stuff doesn't get recorded necessarily. And these kids, like even young kids, like 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, maybe even younger, I don't know, are yelling racial slurs and are yelling curse words and hurling them at everybody else in the lobby. Even, sadly, like 30-year-old men are doing this too. It kind of goes back to this whole boys will be boys thing that John was talking about. But I think video games is kind of a
an untamed or untouched region of social isolation and bullying that we don't really know much about, but we just know it's there and that it's bad.
Yeah, definitely everything that Carl said I agree with. Video games are like a limitless fantasy world that kids live in, and we're exposed to video games at a young age. I mean, I didn't play with them too much, but I know that just anything, you can sign up at the age of 3 and just get on a screen and start playing a game that seems so innocent, but when you start interacting with people, there's such an open-ended world out there where you're being isolated in any way between a chat or who can play a game with you. It's as if anything can really, you can be socially isolated from almost anything, it seems like. And I think video games are just so, they're so not real that kids get carried away within them and so hooked to them, where it can lead to so many more problems outside of it as well. So
there are hundreds of thousands of communities in this country that are outside of urban areas where students don't get the opportunity to reinvent themselves when they go into a new school. And I'm wondering, from your experience, this is addressed to the general, to the panel, what advice do you have for the students, the small groups of students who stay together for 13 years of their life in schools and don't necessarily have the kinds of clubs or external things to participate available to them to address this issue in those communities?
You know, Jeannie, I want to just say that part of our basic principle is to have everything available for free, including all the activities and games and teachers' guides, not to mention no one eats alone. So there really hasn't been a community that hasn't stepped forward. Even kids as young as in fifth grade have gotten involved with No One Eats Alone and brought it to their school. We profiled a young boy named Oscar from San Leandro just about a month ago, and Jenny went to his school on No One Eats Alone Day. He got on a national conference call that was advertised to teachers and said, I would like to bring No One Eats Alone to my school, but I have a challenge. The kindergartners and first graders eat together. The second and third graders eat together, and the fourth and the fifth graders eat together. Does that mean I have to do 3 No One Eats Alone on one day? And we just about died over this kid, and I want to honor him next year. But the answer is yes. If you need to do 3, you'll do 3. And he did the best No One Eats Alone, and we have a little videotape. There's no place in this United States or around the world that cannot be reached by the work that we're doing, by the availability of the tools, by an enlightened child or an enlightened teacher or a parent to bring our work and this kind of kids that you're seeing here today to their community. So I just don't accept that premise, and I think that we're making it really easy, no barriers to getting involved in making our world kinder for their generation and for the ones behind them.
I have a question. I think it's more for Dr. Pantel. I'm wondering, we're talking about social isolation and the health consequences. So when the issue is addressed, and I don't know if this is in the research or not, but I'm curious, can the symptoms, those long-term health complications, be reversed if someone then, changes their lifestyle or, becomes aware of their social isolation perhaps when they're 11 or 12 and, somehow is able to have some kind of intervention? Have you been able to track any of that?
So we haven't been able to track that, although I believe it could be, which is why I do the work that I do. But it's a good question, and I think down the line there will be more studies that do look at it, but we haven't actually tracked the outcome quite yet. But I think there are things you could track that are, subclinical markers in the blood, but also in outcomes and, in terms of depression, in terms of health behaviors, in terms of other things that we could very easily look into that we just haven't quite yet. So stay tuned.
We're about to wrap up.
Right.
Thank you. I just want to thank everybody, and on behalf of Beyond Differences, the demand for what we're doing is outstripping our ability to provide everything that we do. So I just want to encourage everybody to get involved. Our website is posted behind us. We need volunteers in the office, contributions. If you have a child or a grandchild that goes to a middle school and want to bring our programs, feel free. We really are here to serve. And I just want to thank you all so much. But please get involved. This is what you have at stake. These two amazing human beings, and we have two more members of our teen board here, Rose Learman and Adriana Weiss, are here this evening, so I just want to give a shout out to them. I hope I didn't miss anybody, but anyway, thank you so much.
Our thanks to the panel assembled by Beyond Differences, including Laura Thomas, the founder, Dr. Matt Pantel of UCSF, Jonathan Martin, a former NFL offensive tackle, and two high schoolers, Eden Jensen and Carl Heil Simpson for their presentation day. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.